Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, ranked number one podcast by Canadian financial advisors in the 2021 Environix Advisor Digital Experience Study. Joining host Pamela Ritchie for a thorough discussion on the sectors and themes shaping 2022 and beyond is Denise Chisholm, Director of Quantitative Market Strategy, and Christopher Lee, Portfolio Manager. Denise explains why we have to understand what thematic investing is to better understand the potential for disruption in the markets, and what lessons have been learned from 2020, 2021, and throughout the past using historical probability. And Chris introduces the new Fidelity Disruptors class and Disruptive Automation class, two global equity strategies which are designed to invest in innovative business models, emerging technologies, and technologies that the portfolio manager team believes have the potential to disrupt or displace incumbents over time. Chris also expands on the collaborative approach to idea generation for the funds. Denise and Chris also look at the theme of automation, how individual companies' progress towards maintaining disruption is monitored, and what are some of the quant determinants of a disruptive company. Today's podcast was recorded on September 29th, 2021, as a session during our recent Access 2021 event. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Welcome to Denise and to Chris. Great to have you join us here today. Denise, I'll begin with you. Why do we have to understand what thematic investing is, the important pieces of it, to understand what we're going to talk about, which is disruption throughout the investment market? What does thematic investing have to do with it all?
Yeah, I think you have to think about how to use it in a portfolio, right? So thematic investing is really just groups of stocks. And in some ways, everyone has heard me talk about sectors and increasingly about factors. They are just also groups of stocks. So baskets of stocks that you can use as building blocks in your portfolio. So with sectors, you're categorizing a company based on what business line it's in. For factors, you're categorizing a company based on what characteristics it has, whether or not it's a value stock, whether or not it's correlated to yield. And with thematic baskets, instead of sectors or sort of the underlying drivers of individual stocks, it's really about the critical driver or theme. And the real difference between thematic baskets and sectors and factors is it can cut across sectors and factors and cap and the rest of the globe. So some ways it can be an easier building block to use to the extent that it can give you a more discrete, specific building block than either sometimes factors or sectors can provide.
So then how do you decide which themes, for instance, need to in fact be important to this whole process, whether it is kind of value versus growth, whether it becomes the involvement of tech in order to have growth?
Right. So no, that's the important question is when and how much, right? So I think the way you think about the using thematic baskets is about current trends in the market. So there is certainly a debate in the market currently about value or growth. And what's interesting to me studying historical probabilities is that when I look at value or growth, value being the cheapest bottom quartile of stocks and growth being the top growers as forecasted, what you see is those two baskets of stocks actually outperform together about 75% of the time. So as much as we consider it an either-or proposition, history says it doesn't have to be the case. But what's harder is what to use in that building block for growth. And here's where I think you can get a little bit more specific. Value stocks do tend to aggregate well and be very specific. Growth stocks, it's really hard to get a handle on from a sector perspective or from a factor perspective. So factor perspective first. If you look at what grew the fastest in the last 12 months, you'll find it tends to mean revert and doesn't have strong odds of continued outperformance. If you look at what's forecast to grow the fastest next year, you'll also find that forecasts are often wrong. So growth from a factor perspective is a little bit tricky. And from a sector perspective, certainly the knee-jerk reaction from most investors is, well, it's got to be in technology. And if you rank all the sectors, you will find technology as the fastest grower, but not all stocks that grow fast are also technology stocks. And technology as a sector is actually heavily laden with some legacy stocks. So it's not very clear that that actually gets to what investors are looking for in that growth basket. So here's a great example of why thematic baskets like the disruptors, which you can equate to as some way to capture growth, might translate into a building block better than either sectors or factors.
Ah, that's fascinating. Okay, I think I've got that. That is amazing. Chris, please do tell us actually, as we sort of begin discussing this class of funds, what is the story behind it? How did this come together ultimately?
Sure. So the genesis of these funds actually, and ironically, goes back to an innovation story that we posed to our investment team a couple of years ago. And what we were essentially trying to do was to try and crowdsource ideas for grow, how to grow our business, how to innovate our business. And we got many, many great ideas. And one of the ideas that really bubbled to the top of the list was thematic investing. And within that, disruption as a theme. And so we went back to the team and said, okay, give us some of your best disruptive investment ideas. And we got a full menu and a full complement of different ideas. And by taking those and sort of aggregating them kind of honing down into five areas to focus on, those being automation, communications, finance, medicine, and technology. You know, we had a lot of debate in terms of when we wanted to launch these products in April 2020. You might recall that there's a lot of market uncertainty and a lot of volatility. As it turned out, it turned out to be very, very timely. Not only did we initiate or start these funds at essentially what was the bottom of the market, but the pandemic period really served to accelerate and validate a lot of the theses around disruption. And so it was a real fortuitous time to be starting these products.
So it's so interesting to get the backdrop of the story itself and sort of the genesis of how it came together. The strategy itself, just sort of help us through why the strategy works so well for going after idea generation.
So, you know, thematic investing is very horizontal in nature. And so it tends to transcend what are conventional categories, those being things like sectors, market cap, geography. And so one of the things that makes these products distinct, perhaps from what we've seen in the past, is that number one, they're intended to be constructed in a very benchmark agnostic fashion, very intentionally so. They also tend to have a global tilt. So in order to get at that, we really need to rely on a uniquely collaborative process. And one of the ways we do that is to assign and aggregate and pull together teams of what we call portfolio influencers. And these are this is a way to try and capture some of those cross-sectional relationships that's really important to thematic investing. And I'll give you an example. So in the case of automation, the team of portfolio influencers include analysts that cover areas and industries such as multi-industrials, software, consumer companies, and even electronics companies. And we've got folks in the U.S., folks in outside the U.S. as part of this team, really coming together to discuss investment ideas, trends, and ultimately, you know, help with the portfolio selection. And, you know, one of the things that we also think makes this unique is that we're leveraging our systematic and quantitative capabilities in order to assist us in portfolio construction. So what we hope and believe we're delivering is a very thoughtful, optimized, but we're also risk-adjusted exposure to different thematic areas.
And what do you find, here's sort of the philosophical question of what makes a disruptor a disruptor? And I know that it's all of these different pieces that we're talking about, but Chris, can you give sort of an example of the types of things that are inside companies who ultimately become disruptors?
Sure. So in our time in researching this area, you know, disruption comes in many different forms and shapes. But what we found is there are a number of sort of common characteristics that tend to help us identify disruption. First, it tends to start with a large market. From there, you may have, things like removing friction, things like using assets more efficiently, It may be coming up with newer and better ways of serving customers. And oftentimes, and ultimately, it does come down to providing a better customer experience. And what we do find as well, it's leveraging a technological advance to do this. What's interesting as well is you often see the presence of a network effect. So these create platform companies that have the ability to enter adjacent markets, as well as create new markets in many cases. And one last thing that's interesting that's come more apparent more recently is that disruption is also oftentimes a great source of social benefit. So a lot of these characteristics are ever-present in disruptive companies. And one example that does stand out in my mind is Netflix. This is a company that took advantage of, number one, advances in network infrastructure. So when the bandwidth constraints were relieved, they were there to take advantage of that trend. Secondly, the shift from consumer content consumption from the physical to the virtual or digital world. And so they were able to assemble essentially now a 200 million plus growing subscriber base and leverage that for future growth. And what's really interesting is that there's a tremendous amount of optionality in that in terms of monetizing that subscriber base into new areas. You're hearing more and more just recently about them moving into the gaming space, for example. So still more legs to that growth story. You can see how that disruption has spawned itself into even more opportunity.
That's really fascinating. Denise, Chris was mentioning a couple of minutes ago in sort of the genesis of the fund, how it came about, and then ultimately it got tested out at the bottom of the market and you know, the timing. But with that in mind, what really has 2020 and 2021 left us with in terms of lessons and ultimately some of the pieces that are going to go into this fund's strategy and what it's finding?
Yeah, I think some of the correlations that we've seen just over the last 12 months are worth looking at and knowing as investors that they tend not to be sticky. So let's call the disruptive class certainly geared towards growth, because that's essentially what you're capturing, which is, if you are a disruptor in whatever sector you are in, you tend to gain market share and you tend to grow faster, right? So that growth correlation we've seen, again, a lot of what I do is to sort of tie it back to investable macro themes, has been related to interest rates. So there's certainly a narrative built around the fact that lower interest rates have been good for growth companies, because that means that they can grow faster over time and their discounted cash flow is worth more over time. But I think that the problem with that, when we look back historically, is that tends to not be the sticky driver. And that's important for investors to understand. And you don't really have to go back very far to see that growth stocks actually underperformed. And I think it was 2013, 14, 15. Despite the fact that rates went down. So I think that gives you a clue that if you're worried about higher rates, that higher rates aren't necessarily the critical driver. What I see when I look through history that has been the critical driver is really capital spending, or CapEx, or investment spending, sort of the I and the C plus I plus G equation of GDP. And this cycle is dramatically different relative to last cycle when I look at the data. So if last cycle was a very long, slow, drawn out recovery with really a very low level of GDP growth and very limited capital expenditure, this cycle looks dramatically different, because what we've seen is wages and salaries are already 15% higher than they were in the prior peak, which took us until 2015 to get to coming out of the great financial crisis, so last cycle. And the fact that during that demand surge, what we've seen is a drawdown in inventories back to bottom quartile levels. You put those things together, and what you have is much more propensity to have capital spending not only be higher than the prior cycle, but likely be more durable as well. So that's a real theme that I think investors can sort of think about how that's going to be different. And I think the knee-jerk reaction, just like when we think about sector investing and growth and technology, the knee-jerk reaction to CapEx from a sector perspective is often the industrial sector. So the industrial sector, I've often said when I've done pop quizzes, what is the sector that actually outperforms the least when it outperforms? It's actually industrials. Most people guessed utilities or consumer staples or some sort of other more defensively oriented sector. But it's actually industrials because one of two reasons. One, it's very, very diversified. And the second is because winners and losers have really diverged over time. So what you've seen is the companies with high ROEs gaining ground substantially over the companies with low ROEs. And part of that is a winner-take-all phenomenon in terms of who can withstand the cost pressure that usually comes with higher CapEx. So that differential really makes you want to think about slicing industrials from a different perspective and maybe across sectors and factors and across that specific trend, where I would say to encompass more winners is something like a thematic based on automation. And I think that that makes a lot of sense as a building block that's geared to the capital expenditure cycle, which I think looks dramatically different and maybe better placed than S&P 500 industrials GIC.
Hmm. So, Chris, it sounds like from several of the things that Denise just outlined that for the disruptors class, automation is a very important, very interesting driver, ultimately, of this. How, put it into context for us, the automation theme within this overall discussion of disruptors.
Yeah, no, this is a very exciting area. And to touch on a couple things that Denise had mentioned, you know, CapEx, wages, and returns. You know, one of the areas that we like a lot within the area of disruption is factory automation. And, you know, this really sits at the intersection of technology and manual intensity. And for a number of reasons, we think demand growth will still be, and growth opportunity will still be pretty attractive and very pronounced in the coming years. For one, you've got a growth backdrop, which over time has been, you know, relatively mediocre over the past several years. And so there's a lot of focus on improving and driving efficiency, lowering costs to drive profitability. And that gets back to the concept of driving returns. So even though there's CapEx that may sustainably be higher, companies haven't taken their eyes off of improving returns because that's a real value driver. You've got things like offshoring and the diminishing impacts of offshoring and the commensurate increases in wages and cost pressures around labor. And so automation is a great way to sort of get at that. You've got other things such as end product complexity, which requires increased levels of precision as well as continued high levels of throughput. And so a lot of these factors still contribute to a very, very attractive backdrop for things like factory automation and more broadly automation as a theme.
That's so interesting. There's a question coming in here. I'm not sure. I'm thinking maybe, Chris, this is one for you, but for either of you. The question from the investor is, how can you monitor individual companies and their progress towards maintaining disruption trends in their given industries and their companies ultimately?
Sure, I can take a stab at that. So, you know, stepping back, we've got the power of Fidelity Research really underpinning all of these products. And it's what's, I think, unique about this offering is that we're really trying to harness that in a very unique and novel way. And so in terms of being able to research these industries and companies very deeply, that's ingrained in sort of what we do day to day already. And we're really trying to overlay a different lens, a thematic lens, to sort of capture those ideas. But we feel like at the grassroots level, we can do the fundamental work and have the fundamental understanding of each of these companies and related industries. And we feel like we're, you know, frankly, one of the best in the world at doing that.
That's great. I was hoping you'd touch on the fundamental research there. This is, we've been talking about everything from inflation to interest rates. Denise, you were taking us through some of that. Just talk to us about the growth that we're looking at here. How it can or cannot, perhaps, what's the potential to outgrow inflation, for instance, if inflation is stickier than some think? It's a big debate, nobody really knows, but how does it work vis-a-vis the inflation discussion, Denise?
Yeah, when I look at the historical odds, I mean, it's very, as rock solid as they come, that equities are one of the best inflation hedges cycle to cycle historically. So when you say keep up, I think equity baskets, whether they be thematic baskets, whether they be sector baskets, whether they be factor baskets, really have a leg up in providing real returns. Even I'll just give gold as an example. Even when you think about gold the commodity, gold the commodity doesn't have nearly as strong returns when inflation accelerates as equities do. And that's one of the reasons why even gold equities tend to struggle, not because they're not good inflation hedges, because it's really hard to keep up with an equity basket. So from that perspective, I think inflation and outgrowing inflation is easier in sort of the equity part of your portfolio. And in theory, the growth stocks of that should be rewarded higher with higher multiples, even if it's more difficult to grow through inflation.
Interesting. Okay. So, Chris, another question from the audience right now. What are some of the quantitative determinants of a disruptive company? Do you target an ideal earnings, revenue, growth? How does that fit?
So in terms of the quantitative overlay, this is more around the construction of the portfolio. I'd say if you look at some of the characteristics of the companies that tend to be in our disruptive offerings, they tend to be faster growing. They can be more expensive as a result of the optionality in terms of their outlook. And in many cases, they can range from some larger cap, but oftentimes some smaller mid cap companies because they're emerging growth businesses. So those are the types of characteristics that tend to populate these portfolios. We don't necessarily target them, but it's more of a fallout of the overall process in identifying and then putting them into the portfolios.
So I might ask you just to sort of expand that or dig further into it. I mean, the idea of risk mitigation, as you say, sometimes smaller companies initially getting themselves off the ground, becoming perhaps public in the process. The risk mitigation within there sort of goes to what you were saying.
That's right. And that comes back to the portfolio construction in recognition that some of these companies will have some inherent volatility. And so when we put them together into a portfolio setting, we want to make sure that they're having the intended effects and having the ability to impact the outcome of the overall portfolio, but not being outsized in any given way. And so what we do is we assign them based on two factors, really, their sort of adherence disruptive factors being on one side, and then on the other side, some of the more conventional fundamental assessments. And we combine that into what we call a disruptive rating. And we bucket them into one, two, or three levels. And then based on that that level, we then assign sort of the weighting. The ones that we have the highest conviction in both areas tend to get a larger weight. And the ones with a less of a three rating, if you will, would be the smaller positions in the portfolio. But again, very balanced overall, recognizing that there can be a lot of inherent volatility at the security level. But we want to make sure that we're providing the overall kind of exposure in a balanced fashion.
Denise, to what extent does the onshoring theme, and to an extent that also seems a little bit nascent, I don't know if we've necessarily done this before in history in some way where the world globalized and now supply chains are forcing a rethink of certain things. The onshoring of companies, of factories and so on, what role does that play in this overall topic? Can you sort of put it into context for us somehow?
Sure, in some ways a big one, right? I mean, we have never seen it before, but it's a reversal of trend is the way I think about it. So if you look at industrial production going back to we certainly have it from the late 1800s in the US, we've seen share loss over essentially the last 30 years. To the extent that CapEx, regardless of in some ways onshoring, but you can think about it thematically the same way, needs to sort of pivot and change tide, and we need more productive capacity, then I think that the CapEx theme that we were talking about holds. So I think onshoring is a component of that, But I think the CapEx or higher capital expenditure is really the theme that is going to make this cycle definitively different than not only just the last cycle, but potentially the last 30 years. So if U.S. industrial production needs to rise much more than it does in any typical recovery, then that's part of what you're seeing in the onshoring trend. And I think that that's why it's so intriguing to me, the automation portion of what we're talking about.
Chris Lee and Denise Chisholm, a pleasure to hear about these new ideas that are going into the disruptor class. Thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thank you. See you tomorrow.